What I would like to do today is to give an account with gentleness and respect of a Christian vision of same-sex marriage. I don't want to give a reaction to same-sex marriage, and I don't want to give an account with anger and righteous indignation, but rather with gentleness and respect. And that has been really problematic in our culture on both sides of this issue. This is not a thing I would say, oh, this is all the gay community's fault, or this is all the straight community's fault. This has been a very, very volatile issue. And let me just give a bit of perspective. I look around the room and I see kind of an interesting mix of people. Fair number of you are on my end of this divide. And let me just give you a divide. It's the divide between myself and my children. And I grew up in a culture where when I went to junior high and high school, I assumed that there were people in my junior high and high school who were gay or who were homosexual, either lesbian or gay. I didn't really necessarily know who they were, but I knew that they were. And in light of that, when I thought about homosexuality, I thought about it in abstract. I thought about it as a particular type of sexual activity. I thought about it as something that, by my background, I became a Christ follower during that time, but I suppose just given my upbringing all along, I would have felt it was morally wrong. But I thought about it in abstract. Fast forward 30 years. My kids go to a large, bordering on enormous public high school in Redlands. Within a week, they are talking face-to-face with a, you know, out-of-the-closet gay and lesbian other students in their classroom. My daughter, in her sophomore year in high school, had a teacher who the previous year had been Mr. Jones and was now Mrs. Jones when Crystal, walked into her classroom. And so it was a different environment in those 30 years. And let me just tell you the single most interesting and important side effect of that is that when I think about homosexuality and issues related to that, I think about it in abstract. When my children think about it, they think about it personally. I think about homosexuality, they think about Stan. They think about Julie. A face comes to mind, and a concept comes to my mind. That, I would argue, puts my children in many ways in a better place to have this conversation than it puts me. Because they are intrinsically sensitive to the fact that this is a conversation about actual people. They don't have to think one up. And of course, in the course of my years, I have had my share of people who I actually know. I mean, I can put faces on it now, but the funny thing is that isn't my reflex. My reflex is to think about it in the abstract. Their reflex is to think about it personally. Now, there's always dangers with that. So in many ways, they're in a better place. In other ways, they're in a worse place. If I wanted a quick and simple illustration of that, I don't need to think very far of my own mom. On a different issue, on the issue of, you know, could God send someone who's not a Christian to hell? Well, one of her sisters was Buddhist. She passed away. For mom, it's kind of a personal issue when this comes up. She just immediately thinks of her sister. And there's something in her that says, I can't believe that God would send my sister to hell. And I think we all kind of get that. On the other hand, I hope we acknowledge the fact that that isn't necessarily a good argument, but we certainly understand the feeling, and then also the fact of an argument's going to feel different to a person who has that kind of personal attachment than it does to the person who's dealing with it in the abstract. So these are just some preconditions of the background that pertains to this whole area, this whole constellation of issues around homosexual behavior in general, around same-sex marriage in particular, and then also about all kinds of transgender issues. that we live in a culture with a huge generation gap in this conversation. So we are remarkably capable of talking past each other without even knowing it. The best research resource that I have found for trying to mitigate the problems of that is to try and talk with gentleness and respect. And also for me to intentionally try and adopt a posture that says, who's the person? Who's the people that I know who are this way? And it's handy for me. So one of our best friends, her sister is lesbian, and she's been living in a couple relationship for many years. And I know her well, and she knows me, and we talk about things, you know? And so it's helpful to have that in mind and to just picture that person sitting in the audience as I talk about this. Having said all of that, I still feel responsible to give an account of a view of marriage that says the current posture towards same-sex marriage, I think, is wrong. And I think there is a different way to look at that than our culture has looked at it this way. Many of you are plenty old enough, anyone 10 years old and above is old enough to realize, wow, this changed really quickly underneath our feet. So 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when I talked about issues like this, completely different assumptions about what are we dealing with and where are we at. And I don't need to rehash all of that history in terms of the details, but part of what I want to talk about today is what has actually happened with marriage over the course of time, and to talk not just about same-sex marriage, but also talk about, two interesting other categories here. Let me identify three things. Traditional marriage, might call it historic marriage, straight marriage, and same-sex marriage. Now, hopefully the first one and the last one you kind of have an intuition about. Let me just tell you why I've separated traditional marriage and straight marriage. Straight marriage is not a very helpful term. I just kind of threw it out there. Maybe it'll stick for me. Maybe it won't. But here's the idea. There is a tradition of marriage that has been around for a ridiculously long time. And if you read discourse of the last 10 to 15 years, honestly, you'll read some things that people say about this that I find a little bit silly. You know, it's one thing to say we are changing marriage. It's another thing to say there never was anything like a consensus or any sort of norm or expectation about what marriage was like. And I'm like, seriously, when I talk to students about Shakespeare, I teach a ridiculous variety of courses, so I just a year ago was teaching an integration seminar on God and Shakespeare. We're talking about just general stuff on Shakespeare. Look, it's really easy to figure out when you're reading Shakespeare, am I in a tragedy or am I in a comedy? If you're in a tragedy, at the end, everybody dies. If you're in a comedy, at the end, everybody gets married. Oftentimes, it's someone who, when you began, was cross-dressing. I understand that, Shakespearean comedies. But isn't that the interesting thing about the whole cross-dressing thing that Shakespeare loves to do, where you have the person who's actually a woman, who's acting like a man, or vice versa, and whatever this whole play is? It's all built around the fact of the gender difference. And the resolution always comes with matching up the actual male and the actual female within the context of marriage. And I have a quote from a magazine or an editorial written in the LA Times about marriage. This is back in maybe 2005, 2006. And the person made this comment about the only thing that is predictable about marriage is that it's constantly changing. And what we currently call today didn't exist 200 years ago, much less 2,000 years ago. That which we call marriage didn't exist 200 years ago, much less 2,000 years ago. And I always wonder, what in the world is that person trying to say when they say that? Because as I say, I mean, I'm just picking up Shakespeare for one of a bazillion examples, right? Pick up any book, any novel, almost any fairy tale from a multitude of cultures and contexts and places. There isn't some weird ambiguity about what marriage is. And to take a kind of a weird example, I mean, I could say the same thing about slavery, right? We've decided slavery is really wrong. But it isn't like there's this huge ambiguity about what slavery was, right? It was another person owning someone else and them having to do what went. I mean, And of course, there's all kinds of different practices associated with slavery, but there's a core to that notion that's really pretty meaningful. And it's been amazing to me to see in these last, you know, this last decade or so, so much discourse talking about how radically different marriage practices are. And let me just identify, when I'm talking about what I'll call traditional marriage, I'll talk about something which would have been a truism in every cultural anthropology class, I would argue, that was taught until maybe at least the year 2000, and that is there's three universals in human culture: a prohibition against murder, a prohibition against incest, and marriage. And this is cultural, this is not the flaming hotbed of conservative Christian morality, right? These are cultural anthropologists who are simply saying, hey, we took the world tour, and guess what we found out? In basically literally every culture, you find marriage practices, you find prohibitions against incest, and you find a prohibition against murder. And beyond that, all kinds of variability. And of course, within cultural expressions of marriage, there's all kinds of differences with that. And let me point out, there may be differences in how incest is defined in terms of how tightly. It's always going to be, you can't have sex with your kids. Brothers and sisters don't get to have sex. But after that, things, all bets are off. Are first cousins in or out? Well, there's some disagreement. But the point is, you could way overstate the variability on a thing like that. What's important and compelling is the core. And I would simply like to say, though we may not be saying this in cultural anthropology classes today, we haven't changed because of evidence or some new culture that we've bumped into. If we have changed on this point, it's because we don't like what we have found to be the fact, and that is that traditional marriage structures that unite male and female are basically universal. They're united around the issue of procreation and children, most particularly. It's a way to construct what they call kinship ties, if you're doing cultural anthropology. It's identify a person who are somehow now part of a new family unit, and that the both parents, genetic parents, biological parents, have full, that's a bad way to put it because it's a person, but full ownership of the children. These are my children. Well, what if the guy went around and messed around a little hanky-panky over there? That's what we call not my children, and marriage is exactly designed to mark off the boundaries of who's in and out of the family. And a man can sow his seed broadly, but the woman's womb is the doorway to the family. And this is basically the quote, broadly universal structure to marriage. Now, I have all kinds of marvelous, bizarre, funky stories of different cultures and things like that that do things differently, and you find Indian castes of men who are supposed to be warriors, and they go off to marriage, and they have their brother-in-law cover for them while they're back there, you know. I understand there's a million weird things that happen out there. I'm just saying there's a core of marriage that has been so prevalent that even in a hotbed of relativistic studies, people would identify marriage as one of the three universals of human life. Now, of human culture. Now, the interesting thing about that, let me just tease this out a tiny bit. Cultural variation is present that largely attaches to the number of partners, almost never to the gender of partners, or the duration of the union. You don't find marriage cultures that say, hey, you're in for 10 years and then you're out. Whatever our practices on that count are today, you don't find that as the intention of the marriage institution. And you also find it to be an exclusive union. It's sexually exclusive. You have what you might call exclusive sexual rights to your partner's body. Now, you might say, well, what about polygamy? And let me just point out, I said at the outset, the variability, most common variability, attaches to numbers. So you may have a culture that has men who have more than one wife. You can also have cultures of wives that have more than one husband. So you can do bigamous, polygamous kinds of relationships in either direction. Far more common for it to be the man than the woman who is having multiple partners, but you'd find cultures that do both of those things. But it's really, really hard to find a culture that has done this with gender ambiguity relative to the marriage institution up until, obviously, these most recent days. huge variety of ways that marriages are solemnized. I just about said sodomized. Solemnized, you know, it may be a religious thing, it may be a legal thing. Almost always somehow it enters into whatever the methodology is for doing things legally. The core of it seems to be producing children, regulating sexual relations, providing stable care structures for children, and social identity. Who am I? Well, I'm Rick Langer. What have I just done? I've invoked the name of my parents growing out of a family structure. So it answers these really fundamental, rudimentary questions about what does it mean to be human. To give a more fancy definition of it, let me just borrow this from the World Council, the World Congress on Families, gave the following definition. A natural family is a man and a woman bound in a lifelong covenant of marriage for the purpose of, number one, continuation of the species, number two, the rearing of children, number three, the regulation of sexuality, number four, the provision of mutual support and protection, number five, the creation, I love this phrase, of an altruistic domestic economy. What in the world does that mean? That means you pay for your kids' education and they don't pay you back. I mean, not that I'm just speaking personally here, I'm just letting you know that that might be what that means. And likewise, my money is my wife's money and my wife's money is my money. She has these two chairs that have traveled with us for like 30 years. They are the singularly most uncomfortable chairs ever invented by the human species. I'm sure of it. They could be in the Ripley's, believe it or not, for least comfortable chairs ever made. But they're pretty, and they have been redone with leather, and they're antiquely connected to Uncle somebody or another. And I've been unable to get them out of the house, and I came thinking, I wonder if I offered Sherry $200 for these chairs, if I could then give them away. But the problem is my money's her money anyhow. I can't pay her anything because every time I get a buck, it's not really my buck, it's not really her buck, it's our buck. So I can't buy those silly chairs out of my garage. If anyone wants an antique, but they're wonderful chairs, they're beautiful, you might be interested in talking to me afterwards. Be happy to pass them on down the road with a generous offer to my wife. Well, it's weird how that goes when you think, how do I buy something from my wife? I can buy something for her. But this altruistic domestic economy, our money is our money. So this is one of the interesting creations of marriage. And a maintenance of bonds between the generations. I look around the group here and I go, yeah, a few of you are probably sitting here thinking about all this. You're aging. We've told great stories. I've been through the whole divorce revolution. You know, my age group, everyone of the late 50s remembers a time before no-fault divorce. We had no-fault divorce, and one of the great lines was, hey, it's a great thing for the kids because they get more people who care for them rather than less. You have four significant adults in your life, or six, or whatever the number is. And I'm just wondering, how's that going to pan out when you're 93 and one of a collection of six parents who allegedly were the significant others in the life of your 54-year-old child who lives 1,000 miles away across the country? Will they come to your side? Will they be by your bed? Will they move you into your house? Or will you suddenly discover we have broken down the kinship ties between the generations by our marital practice? Please note, I have said nothing about same-sex marriage, right? I'm talking about straight marriage here. So, these are the things that marriage has traditionally existed to produce. This is what I would call traditional and historic marriage. Like I say, it is certainly a thing that has a variety of things associated with it, but a remarkably common core that hopefully I have now identified for you clearly. Straight marriage, well, what's the difference, right? You may say, well, isn't that just what straight marriage is? I'm looking for a term to describe the phenomenon of, let me just talk predominantly about American marriage, but I could equally say Western marriage, between about 1965 in about 2005, because around 2005, the whole same-sex marriage thing began to get real momentum. In the intervening 50 years or so there, 40 years, We did some amazing things to marriage that had absolutely nothing to do with same-sex marriage and homosexuality. We went through a sexual revolution that had huge impacts on the kind of marriage that we were practicing. And all I'm trying to say is straight marriage is the term I'm going to use for this weird phenomenon that was what we got right before we ended up with whatever we've got now. So there became an interesting change, a very fundamental change in what we thought of with marriage, courtesy of all of us who were doing the sexual revolution thing. And we've ended up with a really weird and different thing. I don't know what to call it. I could call it sexual revolution marriage or something like that, but that just became clumsy and said, okay, let me just call it straight marriage. And that's what kind of arose. And so what I want to do is talk about that transition right now. How we went from what you might call traditional marriage to whatever it is that we had, my placekeeper, straight marriage, before I talk at all about really same-sex marriage, because I don't think we'll understand same-sex marriage fairly and accurately until we've understood the transition that took place between traditional marriage before same-sex even came on the map. So, in light of this, whoops, I'm really having a hard time with my arrows. What happened to traditional marriage? Basically, two things, two major changes. Number one was the elevation of choice and preference satisfaction to be the defining human value. The most important thing about me is my free choices. I get to choose and do whatever I want. I was just talking to one of my classes today about, I guess it's about stuff with giving. And I talked about, you know, one of the weird things that we do when we talk to people about giving is we sometimes make people feel guilty for the money that they have. We'll tell them stories about, do you realize that you're in the upper 98th percentile of the richest people in the world, yet you only give 2% of your income or 1%? People, oh, we feel so guilty. And here's my little thesis, side point here. Way better motivation for giving, gratitude rather than guilt. Guilt is remarkably unproductive for making people change the open-handedness with which they deal with their money. Gratitude is remarkably effective. And we were talking about this, and then someone talked about, people talking about the duty to give, and you need to do your duty. And it was really funny how, you know, one of the students said, and someone said, yeah, it's kind of the same feeling you have about being made to feel guilty. Isn't that really the same thing? And I said, you know what? I think descriptively that would be accurate today. That when you're told to do your duty, it's kind of this, it's the same thing as we feel with guilt. I would just like to point out, 100 years ago, doing your duty was a positive term. Your duty was a noble thing, and to have done your duty was to have been a noble person. Discharging duties was a thing a person would aspire to. Now we aspire to making ourselves happy. So there has been an incredible change within 100 years about our attitude towards words like duty, commitment, fidelity, faithfulness as praise terms. And now I swear to you, if I was at Biola right now speaking in a chapel and I asked people to be honest and asked them the question, would you rather be authentic or holy? They'd say authentic. Holy has become almost a slam term. When you say holy, you've almost said holier than thou, which is to say something really bad. Now that to me also seems really weird, because is the competition really that high that to be holier than thou, whoever thou is really such a compelling accomplishment? I don't think that should qualify for the Nobel Prize. Actually, as I look around, it seems like I could be holier than a whole lot of thous and still leave a lot of room for improvement. But that said, I look out at the audience that I teach at Biola, and I go, these are a batch of people with aspirations to authenticity, but not to holiness. And in so doing, they are simply reflecting a movement of our culture. 100 years of going down that river, and I discover that, yes, we as Christians have gone down that river too. So we have elevated choice and preference satisfaction to be the defining human value, and of course we have applied that to marriage. in this context. Second thing we have done, we have the rise of technology as a way to adjust creation to the givens of our desires rather than adjusting our character to the givens of creation. This is a really interesting point. Let me, quoting C.S. Lewis is always good because he's always clearer than anything else, anybody else. So, wow, what did I do with that delightful quote from C.S. Lewis that was so painfully clear? Now we're in trouble. Oh yeah, here we go. The rise of technology is a way to empower and exalt human choice over nature. Adjust creation to the givens of our desire rather than adjusting our character to the givens of nature. Here's what Lewis says. There's something which unites magic and applied science that also separates them both from wisdom of earlier ages. Now, this is really a thing. He's talking about the, it's a really little thing, interesting thing he has about talking about how similar in some ways science is to magic. Long story, really interesting story, but he's making a really specific application of that point here now. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality. And the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. That was how you made your soul conform to reality, and that was the key to living successfully. Because reality wasn't going to budge. And if you wanted to live successfully in the real world, you needed to conform your soul to the contours of external reality. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is some sort of technique. And both, in the practice of this technique, both science and magic, are ready to do things that hitherto have been regarded as disgusting or impious, such as digging up and mutilating the dead, and he goes on and Fiora lists of the kinds of things that people will do in the name of science or of magic. And he says, this whole thing is a way to shift the world so it's the way you want it to be. So let me give you just a very obvious example of a way that I would like to be, but previous generations have said that's a bad way to be, and the only way to solve that is to change your character and your conduct. But now technology has solved that problem, and here it is. I'm a male, and I find females sexually attractive, and therefore I want to act out on my desire. The old wisdom was, you need to learn to control your desire. You cannot express the desire for just anybody you want. Why? Because reality pushes back. You have sex with someone, they get pregnant, dad finds out, he beats you over the head, he runs you out of town on the rail, you become an exile living in some strange country. Bad things happen, don't go there. How do we solve this problem? By separating sex from children. If I can have sex and never have to worry about the consequences, guess what? I have adjusted the world to my desires rather than my desires to the world. And suddenly, free sex, for the first time in human life, became a reasonable, potentially viable option for a way to live. Why? Basically because of a technological innovation, the pill. It worked well enough that a person had a fairly significant expectation that if I took the pill, I wouldn't get pregnant. So we split apart sex and childbearing. Well, the interesting side effect of that is when the consequence of sex is bearing a child, you have this interesting problem that shows up. Not only whatever went on problematic with you know, your relationship with a person and how you're going to manage your affections and all these kinds of things, out comes the kid. And the kid has to be taken care of. So we need to do something so the kid can be reared and can grow up and can live and can get an identity and can get a start in life. And by the way, kids are really slow to pick up on that. I mean, my dog has a baby. Baby is good to go. I mean, within a year, that new dog is chasing every cat in the neighborhood. We're all good to go. What else does a dog need to know? Eat, chase cats, we're good. 1 year out, problem solved. Does not work with children. Got a 29-year-old right on the bubble. I think she's going to make it. So you realize, wow, this is really a long-term project here. So once we got the girl pregnant, That wasn't the end of the problem. We had to figure out, what do we do with the child? And by the way, birth control by the pill was as inaccessible, unsafe, and unpredictable as birth control by abortion. There was no retroactive birth control done with abortion, right? So when the girl got pregnant, the baby was coming. There was no way out. So you created whole structures in your society to manage that. That's gone. You can have sex with whoever you want, they won't get pregnant. If they do, they can get an abortion. And all of those things have changed in terms of our social expectations. Guess what? Our marriage structures have changed with that as well. So we've ended up with a world that has split that apart technologically. And then the other thing that we have done is had a social development, like I say, the abandonment of duty for the sake of personal happiness, that has combined with that. So marriage has now become a remarkably different institution than it used to be. Let me just read the phrases I gave you, and you all kind of nodded your head when I gave it to you. The continuation, what's the point of a natural family's marriage? Continuation of the human species, rearing of children, regulation of sexuality, provision of support and protection for the partners, creation of this altruistic domestic economy, maintenance of bonds between the generations. You know something that's missing in there? It's a four-letter word. Love. Yeah. Let me just point this out. Historically, we have lived in a world of arranged marriages, which means basically that marriage precedes love. You learn to love in the context of marriage. By the way, all of us who married for romantic love, do you really disagree with that statement? I know what you thought when you got married, but most of us have been married for 33 years, nod our heads and say, yep, that kid's right. You learn to love after you get married. I don't know what I was thinking before, but I'll tell you now, you learn to love after you get married. And by the way, the point of a marriage vow is not to enhance the love or to fan it into flames or something like that. It's to keep the union together once love fades or fails. The point of marriage is absolutely independent of love. It hopes, it may even command that you cultivate love, but the marriage itself is exactly designed to keep people together when normal bonds of affection wouldn't. It's exactly designed to keep it more durably together, so for the sake almost always of the children and the broader integrity, so to speak, of human society. Marriage is exactly designed around not feeling, but obligation, duty, legal structures. Mainly, not for the well-being of mom and dad, but for the well-being of the children. Wow. So I've been teaching a class at BOA called Money, Sex, and Power for 10 years. You wouldn't believe the number of conversations I've had with BOA students about marriage. And when I float the idea that marriage is not primarily about love, you would have think I had sprouted antenna and just informed them that, by the way, I came from Mars. It's an unthinkable thought. And let me almost make that literal claim. It is an unthinkable, it's a thought that we do not think. We have so equated love with marriage that we think love defines marriage. And I would argue that's not true. The hope and prayer is that love emerges from marriage. Fiddler on the Roof got it right. Do you love me? I don't know. Do I love you? I darn your socks, I feed you clothes. That's not right. I do, all these things I do for you. Do you love me? And it's like, yes, I love you. And then they look at each other and say, well, it doesn't make any difference, but after 25 years of marriage, it's nice to know. But the core of the marriage wasn't this feeling of love. And of course, Fiddler on the Roof is all about this tension between romantic roots of marriage and traditional structures of marriage. So, this is the change that has taken place in straight marriage, in traditional marriage, to this place where you have straight marriage. And as I say, what you've done is split apart procreation from marriage. You've split apart sex from marriage because you can have sex with anybody. So you want to have sex with someone, you don't have to marry them, just have sex with them. So all of these things that used to be united together, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in the baby carriage. We sing about it in our jump rope thing. These things are somehow organically united in our thinking, have now all three been split apart from each other. They are not separate steps on a staircase that you would have to climb up. They aren't even separate floors of a single house. They're like three different buildings. Go to whichever one you want. You want to have sex? Go to the sex building. You want to have kids? You can have kids. Go to a baby donor place. Go adopt one. You don't have to be married. You don't have to have a relation. You can do it yourself. The kid thing's over here. The marriage thing's over here. The sex thing's over here. You choose. Well, notice how completely departed this is from what I described as traditional marriage structures. Number one. Number two, let me observe how completely this was done by the straight community, not the gay community. And that's why I'm giving it the honorific straight marriage, because we did it. We did it. This is our gift to American society. Those who are my age, we did it. We have dismantled and separated straight marriage from traditional marriage. And whatever we want to pin on the gay community, on homosexuality, on all these other things that go on and we wave our hands and say, oh, this is all a bunch of crazy stuff. Let me just tell you, the biggest thing that has happened are the things that we have done ourselves. Now, let me illustrate this with a really helpful quotation. What time is it? Yeah, I'll just keep rolling here. I want this quote. Where is it? Okay. So here's a quote from New Yorker magazine. So this is not, you know, a Christian source talking about this. This is just a guy writing in New Yorker magazine. You can't read this, so let me read it out loud to you here. The choice of whom to marry has become less about satisfying the demands of family and community than about satisfying oneself. Notice we just talked about that, right? When you add the contraceptive and reproductive technologies, which we just talked about, that have separated sex from procreation, what you have is a model of heterosexual marriage that is grounded in and almost entirely sustained on individual preference. This is a historically peculiar state of affairs, and one that would have been alien to our ancestors and to most traditional cultures today. And here's the kicker. And it makes the push for gay marriage inevitable. Because if all marriage is a special way for the government to bless your personal preferences, what possible ground could you give for saying a gay person's personal preferences shouldn't be blessed and a straight person's should if you're living in a radically pluralistic society? And let me just be honest. If that is what marriage is, I do not have any argument to give you against same-sex marriage. If that's all it is, a way for the government to bless your personal romantic privileges in a pluralistic society, I do not have a good way to give you an argument against same-sex marriage. So the things that I will say about this issue are entirely dependent on the notion that there's something deeply wrong with straight marriage. And we have crafted a situation so our normal expectations of marriage are so distant from what marriage has traditionally been that it becomes almost inconceivable that you couldn't allow straight marriage and gay marriage, or same-sex marriage, to both coexist, because it's all a matter of personal preferences. And all the traditional things about procreation, children, the duration that travels to that are just irrelevant, because that's not what we've made straight marriage about anymore. That's the situation in which we live. Now, let me go back real quick to a couple, my back and front are really going bad here. A couple of quick observations about the changes that have gone on. Love, in this transition from traditional to straight, love has replaced legal vows and duty. I think the second saddest thing that I heard about marriage this summer was the Supreme Court decision, which I disagree with. I think it was a bad decision. I don't think it's good for our country in the long run, but Yeah, it happened. I think the saddest thing I heard was a description of a marriage ceremony that a friend of mine went to. A couple of non-Christian folks that were cousins or related to him somehow. And they go up this thing, and the guy who's officiating says, yeah, okay, so by laws of the state of California, for no reason that I could possibly imagine, they have invested me in authority to declare you guys man and wife. So let me just do this thing here. Do you take her to be your best friend? Yes. And do you take him to be your best friend? Yes. All right, let's party. End of marriage ceremony. Let me read California Family Code. It has one of these little Q&A sections in here attached to section 400 to 406, I believe. Where do I register to perform marriages in California? The laws of the state of California make it unnecessary for persons performing marriages to file credentials with the clerk of the court or with anyone else. The county and state are removed from any responsibility for verification of credentials. The state does not maintain a central registry for members of the clergy. Any concern for verification is totally at the discretion of the parties to the marriage. Wow, I hope they don't run our hospitals that way. So you realize, again, this is straight marriage I'm talking about, right? The couple I'm talking about, you know, it was a traditional couple, male and female. The person who was officiating was doing it according to the laws of the state of California. Trust me, he registered with no one. I really believe that. I really do. He did not register with anyone. So this is what our marriage structure has become. And let me point out, what we think we will get out of it is predominantly personal happiness, not social stability, which was the old, what you might call telos or goal of marriage, was to create a stable ground in which human society would grow and flourish, both by producing and creating a context in which the next generation can be reared. And the individual has replaced, let me put it this way, individual rights have replaced the human institution of marriage. So marriage is no longer an institutional thing. It's a privatized, individualized right sort of a thing. As one eloquent scholar put it, one view is that the vow is prior to the couple. The vow, the way of living together as husband and wife, the institution, exists on its own, exerting authority that's independent of the couple. In a sense, the vow helps to create the couple. On their wedding day, the couple becomes accountable to an ideal of marriage that is outside of them and bigger than they are. A newer view is that the couple is prior to the vow. The way of living, the institution, is less of an external reality like the weather than a subjective projection that derives meaning almost entirely from the particular couple. Instead of the vow creating the couple creates the vow. Couples write vows, right? We love it. This is one of the things I do when I do weddings. I said, look, I would prefer, here's the deal for the vow. Number one, I'd like you to do a traditional vow as a reminder of the fact that marriage isn't really that blessed to have you. I mean, nothing personal, but it just isn't. It's been around for 3,000 years, and my hope is, God willing, it may be here for 3,000 years. So you're pretty much just a blip on marriage's radar. It exists a long time before you did, and it's going to be around a long time after. And what you do or don't do, it's not that big a deal. I think you're pretty blessed to have marriage. So you need to enter marriage on marriage's terms, not your own. Now, if you're really committed to using your own words, I'm not committed to the King James Bible or the Book of Common Prayer's wording. So you can run a marriage vow by me, and I will ask the question, does it unity, fidelity, eternity? What are you pledging here? If you're pledging those things that go into marriage, I'm happy to do the ceremony for you. But you don't get to choose your vows. And let me just read a little clip from a Christian website on marriage. We followed our culture. Oh, if you'd like a traditional ceremony, ask your church official for the written words and then read them over with your partner to see if they're right for you. Whatever Christian wedding vows you choose, it should be a reflection of your faith and the life that you are starting together. Christian wedding vows, no matter how traditional or unique, should reflect the shared values of the couple in question. If you wish the nature of your wedding vows to be faith-based, there's endless possibilities to choose from. This is a highly personal decision, and the right vows can only be chosen by you and the officiant who's performing the marriage. This is the Christian website on marriage. So I think you're getting my drift here. That one of the things that gets me a little testy about this conversation is that we're blaming a ton of stuff on the gay community that has nothing to do with the gay community. And we're refusing to look in the mirror and ask, what have we wrought with the way we have treated and handled marriage as straight people? We have celebrated our technology. We have pursued radical libertarian freedom. We have expressed our sexuality however we want. And we have said, roughly speaking, consequences be damned. And we've woken up one morning with a version of marriage that is such that it is inconceivable to the average person how it could not be applied to gay marriage because of how far it has moved from the traditional roots of marriage. Aren't you glad you came tonight? But I feel sometimes like I just have to say that to us. Because it really bothers me that we start blaming someone else for the things that really we have done. Both the straight community in general, but also the straight community within the church, right? We are not so very radically different than the culture that spawned this. Now, having said all this, you could ask, of course, you know, what's happened to marriage? I just give you a quick shot of divorce rates here. 1900, 7% of marriages ended in divorce, which is about the average number, by the way, for cultures that do arranged marriages. Just in case you're interested. 1930s, 16% of marriages ended in divorce. 1940, 20%, 50, 26, 65, 25, so basically remained steady there. 1970, 33%, beginning of our sexual revolution here. By 1980, 52%. We had done that clean sweep, factor of, you know, 700x increase in rates of divorce over this 65 or 75 year period, roughly speaking. The other hidden thing that goes with this is radically declining birth rates. We have multiplied sex and decreased fertility. And we have indeed separated childbearing from marriage. So now, literally in our country, more babies are born out of wedlock than in wedlock. Well, so 50-50, you know, check the year. But that has happened underneath our feet. So the interesting thing here, today the average woman in the world bears half as many children as her counterpart did in 1972. No industrialized country still produces enough children to sustain its population over time or to prevent rapid population aging. Yes, we can make children by fill in the blank, artificial insemination, sperm donors, surrogate motherhood, such an incredible list of technology of how we can make children. Are we making more children? Let me just tell you sociologically what makes children. Traditional marriage. In the countries that have dismantled traditional marriage, you see breathtakingly low birth rates. So, for example, Western Europe, prevailing birth rates, let me just generalize here in a handy way, 1.4 children for every 2.1 adults. Zero population growth is 2.1 children for every two adults, I should say. You need just a little bit more than two, because some people are infertile and people die and whatever. So you need about 2.1 children for every two adults. Right now we're at 1.4. That is a full 33% lower than reproduction rates. You know what percentage of the population died in Europe during the Black Plague? 33%. We've done it. We've had the same effect on population over a generation that the Black Plague did, simply by radical decrease in fertility. Why are people not having these children? Is it because of, you know, physical infertility? No, we're creating structures that, in effect, de-incentivize marriage, make the predictability of the life that a child is going to have uncertain. It fosters an environment where people don't want to rear children, and so they don't, and we have the technology to allow them to opt in or opt out. Sex without children, right? So this has been the interesting side effect. The U.S., interestingly enough, is up at about 2 children for every 2 adults, so it's slightly below reproduction levels just because, like I say, it doesn't quite get there. And the number one explanation for that, great article in Wilson Quarterly, basically, we're the most religious country of the developed world. And you can basically track fertility rates to religion and traditional marriage structures. And as the guy who's writing this article says, and indeed, the righteous shall inherit the earth. You know, it's one of those kinds of traditions. So these are just things, and just by the way, I understand I'm talking to a culture that doesn't really care about much of things I've just said, so let me just remind you, it is indeed the economy, stupid. So what happens when you're saying, hey, I'm going to, when I retire, I'll sell my house and live off the income that I've accumulated from paying off the house? If you have 33% fewer people, what will that do to the housing market? When I retire, I'll give away my house. And you go, wow, yeah, and how do we pay for Social Security? How do we pay for all these things when we fail to make the next generation? Now, there's an argument to get our culture's attention. All this moral riffraff, who cares? But man, when you start talking about the economy, now things get me scared. So this is the world that we have created. This is the world that we find ourselves living in. What do you want to say about these things? And is there anything to say about this? Are these changes better or worse? Are vows better than romantic love? Is public more important than private? The social thing more important than private satisfaction? Is duty more important than happiness? These are these questions that I'm raising, and I think you can tell I have my own sentiments about this. But what justifies a traditional institutional model of marriage? Is it anything other than your taste among these different issues? And let me try to offer an argument that has nothing to do with biblical revelation, because this is one thing I haven't mentioned yet, but another one of my little pet peeves is when we as Christians, or our predominant culture, calls marriage a Christian institution. Let me ask the question, why do we think it's a Christian institution? Let's make this simple. Did it exist before Jesus? Did it exist before Abraham? Did it exist before Noah? Before Abel and Cain? Oh, yeah. Marriage is a human institution. It is a divinely ordained human institution. And when we start calling it a Christian institution, we're just saying something weird, honestly. And our culture has been playing this line, so this didn't used to be that big a deal to me because I didn't hear it that much, and I didn't usually say that except in exclusively Christian contexts. Well, the last 8 to 10 years, people are saying, oh, it's just a religious thing, and you know, Christian marriage. And they go on and I'm going, have you ever gone to India and asked them, do you have marriage? And what the marriage looks like? Oh, it's a Hindu institution. Well, why don't you take a trip to Cambodia? What do you find out? Oh, it's a Buddhist institution. Great, we're on a roll now. Let's go to Jakarta. Oh, it's a Muslim institution. Let's go to the Soviet Union. Oh, it's an atheist institution. Tell me when to stop, but I would just like to say it is not a Christian institution. Of course, as Christians, we have distinctive ways and practices we carry out the universal human institution of marriage. But Christians have spent a lot of time buying off on a line that I don't think we should, number one. And number two, in the name of being really good in spiritual teaching things about marriage that I think really aren't actually accurate. So to say the essence of marriage is symbolizing the union between Christ and his church. Well, let me just ask, how many people in India are symbolizing the union between Christ and the church by their wedding? And if not, is it not a wedding because it didn't get the by their marriage, because it didn't capture the essence? Let me just say the essence of marriage is exactly the traditional marriage institution. It is a human institution. expressed in a wide variety of religions and cultures, basically ubiquitously. So I'm going to avoid making any Christian arguments for marriage because I just don't want to reinforce that perception, number one. Number two, I don't think they're going to sell anything in our culture by saying it's Christian. Let me make a case for marriage, traditional marriage, completely independent of any concerns of religion or any mandates of morality. Okay? Is this possible? Let me give a suggestion. This is what you might call a natural law argument for marriage. Natural law is reason reflecting on nature. So just you think about the object in question, what is true of it, and in light of that, how should we then live? So some observations about human nature. Number one, we're sexually dimorphic creatures who mate for life. Wow, doesn't that sound cool? Okay, here's the gig. I took botany when I was in college. And I remember this person talking about the haploid and the diploid part of the life cycle. I still am permanently scarred by him walking up to me saying, "No, we will talk about the life cycle of the liverwort." And he goes up and he draws this life cycle, the same life cycle every time, because he goes, here's the part where the sexes are split apart, here's the part where the sexes come together, and he draws a life cycle on the board. And you discover some plants are sexually dimorphic, male and female, believe it or not, male and female cottonwood trees. Male cottonwood trees are illegal in large portions of Colorado. Why? You think teenage boys are bad at spreading their seed, you should see a cottonwood tree. So they spread this cotton all over the way. You walk out and there's cottonwood seeds on your car and everything. And so they said, look, no, one male cottonwood tree, preferably located in Wyoming, will be enough to produce all the cottonwood trees we need on planet Earth. So let's send them to Wyoming, no more here. So cottonwood trees are sexually dimorphic. That's all we're saying. This is not a moral argument. We just checked. And don't ask me how they mate. I have no idea. Their little roots go up at night. No, what in the world do you do? Anyhow, so some things are sexually dimorphic. Human beings number among those. Very simple observation. Number two, unlike 97% of primate species, of mammalian species, we mate for life. This is just natural history. This is, you know, a zoologist would answer this question. You don't need an ethicist. You don't need a theologian. You say yes. Most mammalian species do not mate for life. Human beings do. There you go. Secondly, human children require long-term nurture. Just as I said, 1 year doesn't do much for you. You better plan on 20, 30, 60, whatever you need. Third, male and females are an approximately equal portion in the population. So it isn't like, you know, the drones and the queen and all these other kinds of things. You have all kinds of different things in the animal world. I'm just making the observation in the human part of the animal world, the sexes come 50-50. Doesn't have to be that way, but that's how it is. Whoopsie. We need a larger social group than just a nuclear family in order to flourish. This is one of those interesting things. So back to my botany kind of stuff here. We are what's called a gregarious animal. We don't just live in pods, but we live in complex pods. And we don't flourish well apart from having others around us. And we specialize, we figure out all kinds of things in order to transform the environment to make it into a healthy human habitation. And then finally, we have strong historical consciousness and are vitally dependent on prior generations for knowledge and deeply invested in future generations emotionally. Is there anyone who would like to disagree with either of those two claims? I mean, I'm just trying to describe the psychological facts I see on the ground. So with these things in place, let me just match up a feature of human nature that we've just talked about with an aspect of traditional marriage. Number one, we're sexually dimorphic creatures. That means we have to do male and female to produce the next generation. That's just what the phrase means. You've got to do something to get male and female together. Human children require long-term nurture, so you're going to have to get them together for the long haul, not the short haul. Male and female are an equal percentage in the population. Let me be blunt. That means polygamy doesn't work. I'm going to go crazy here. There has never in the history of the world been a polygamous society. That sound like I've gone off the rails? Let me just make an observation. What we call polygamous societies are always and only a polygamous elite. Someone who's rich, someone who's powerful, someone who's king, someone who's whatever, gets to get more wives or more husbands. But the bottom line is, husband and wife is a zero-sum game. If I take four, that means three other people didn't get one. Right? So you cannot do a polygamous society. You can only have a polygamous elite within your overall monogamous society, because that's just what the numbers are. No moral argument here. I'm just Mr. Math. I rang it up. If you take three, that means someone else has got to give up too. So there we have it. So that's just a brute fact that emerges from human nature. Oops. We flourish in social groups larger than families, so we need a social and legal expression of marriage. We need the thing to mark out, are you married or are you not? One of these rings, ever found yourself looking at someone's finger to see if there's a ring? Ever found yourself putting your ring on? See that? You're trying to send a message to someone who's sending a message that you don't want to hear. So we have these markers that say, I am someone's. I'm owned. I'm kept. I'm committed. I'm attached. We have these sort of markers. We have legal institutions that reinforce that. And then finally, we have this historical consciousness, so we need to produce the next generation and provide continuity with the prior generation. What does this describe? I think I actually, I don't put it there. So basically what I've described is a lifelong heterosexual procreative union between male and females that is legally recognized and socially constitutive of a community, which sounds ridiculously like the definition of marriage I gave you at the beginning, right? Traditional marriage. Where did we extract this? From our theology? No. From moralizing? No. From human nature. And the question when you look at some of these things is, does same-sex marriage generate these same goods, and should it therefore be equally incentivized, because that's really what we're asking, by governmental structures? And I would argue that when you go down this list, you suddenly realize, well, it fails right at the top. It isn't sexually dimorphic by definition, same sex. It's not going to be producing a next generation. Lifelong is an interesting one. That is part of the interesting issue. And let me just say, okay, maybe it will generate lifelong unions. The thing that it doesn't tend to do by intentionality is exclusive unions. So it's really interesting to read gay people talking about gay marriage. And Andrew Sullivan, Dan Savage, some of the, you know, key influential spokesmen about this will often point out, look, the gay community is way better adjusted on this stuff than the straight community. The straight community, when somebody cheats on someone, when somebody is not exclusive as a sexual partner, they freak out. This is true. Said, the straight community has a lot to learn from the gay community, because we don't usually talk about monogamy, we talk about fidelity. And fidelity means you don't lie about your other partners. But it doesn't mean you don't have other partners. And so Dan Savage is really upfront about this in terms of saying, yeah, we need to be game, we need to have, you know, kind of open sexuality with this. And it is not uncommon in the gay community to be very contentious about that issue of exclusivity and monogamy, traditionally understood, at the same time being very committed to fidelity. In other words, I don't lie to my partner about this. We talk this through. This is part of the arrangement. But I'm just pointing out, you know, what you've done now is create an institution that no longer is exclusive, no longer is male and female, no longer is procreative. And I just wonder, why do we call it marriage? Is it not something else? And again, trying to avoid getting overly charged on the moral issues, to simply ask the question, well, gee, maybe this is a partnership. There could be all kinds of other things that we do with this, but it seems to me to be departed from the traditional notions of marriage. Now, here's the response that I will commonly hear from people in the gay communities. Rick, you are just a dinosaur. You are living with a notion of marriage that died 50 years ago. I'm not sure they're wrong. When they say that, I go, that's right, but I would also like to point out, human nature didn't die 50 years ago. And I'm just telling you, we're clipping coupons on our past right now, and this plane's going to crash, and I don't think further dismantling the definition will be helpful. But other people say, it's dismantled enough, can't you just get over it? And that's where I think we have a tension on this issue. And I don't have some wonderful solution to that problem. I'm just making the observation that this is where that tension often plays out. And I think, as I say, they have a fairly good argument. They say, look, if what we've got now is marriage, why won't you let gay people marry? It's completely separated from all these traditional functions that marriage has been, all the things that it's traditionally defined. So you're just being testy, anachronistic, moralistic, religious, something, but I wish you'd get over it and let us get on with it. So that's the way the conversation goes on this. And the other thing that I think the gay community does want to say is that there's a part of marriage that they find attractive, and I think it is part of the stability and other things like that that I think has been a thing that they feel like we've created whole social structures that simply alienate the community. So the things that have become norms and expectations within the gay community have perhaps not been the healthiest, and they might actually end up with the gay community in a better place if they're allowed to deal more with the, you know, traditional human marriage structures and things like that. So this is another argument that I hear coming back on this issue. And wouldn't you rather have, even if a person's gay, wouldn't you rather have them one partner than 12 or more? But this is the one that I hear mainly coming from heterosexuals or in the press. But when you actually listen to the gay community, I don't think you find that being the prevailing ethos. The exclusivity monogamy thing is a thing that is a lot more ambiguous, I guess, in that community from what I have, you know, from what I've read. So this is an overview of these issues. I think what I'd like to do is stop here, let us take a break, and then we will do Q&A about all the different things. I realize I probably opened a can of worms here more than closed it. That's fine, because we'll have Q&A time to talk about those things. So is stuff back there, Dave?
Yeah.
All right, so head back that way, and we'll be back here in 10 minutes. What are we giving people?
Yeah, 10
minutes. All right.